Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bill Fletcher of Trans-Africa Forum, who discusses Haiti's flawed presidential election and the challenges ahead for the winner, René Préval. Human rights activist Jennifer Harbury, who examines the practice of torture in U.S. detention facilities and the call by a U.N. panel for the closure of the American prison camp at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. And Nick Robinson, a Yale law student and director of the Human Rights Clinic, who describes the movement that succeeded in pressuring Yale to divest its holdings in companies doing business with the nation of Sudan. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over the last year, 100,000 people have fled their homes in renewed fighting in the province of Katanga in the northeast district of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. According to the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, thousands fled the clashes between Congolese troops and Mai Mai rebels, who control most of the mineral-rich area. The civilians lived in the African jungle for months after their homes were burned out and family members were killed or raped. The displaced villagers are now facing an outbreak of cholera, malaria, and a severe shortage of food. In January, Doctors Without Borders confirmed nearly 1,200 cases of cholera in the war-torn Katanga province. The International Rescue Committee has called the Congo the world's worst humanitarian disaster, with 38,000 people dying every month. In a recent health study, the aid group estimated 4 million died in the Congo, mostly from disease, from 1998 to 2004. The crisis is centered in the war-torn eastern Congo, which has a mortality rate nearly double the rate of sub-Saharan Africa. In early February, several gunmen from local drug gangs attacked the newspaper offices of El Mañana in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, across the border from Laredo, Texas. A journalist was critically injured in the assault. In response, the paper's owner, Ramon Cantu, halted all active investigative reporting of violent drug gangs. Instead, the leading newspaper announced that in the future, it would only report the facts of drug-related killings and avoid any follow-up reporting. According to the Interpress Service, a surge in drug trafficking along the U.S.-Mexican border has made it the most dangerous place to work as a journalist in Latin America. So far, over 100 people have been killed this year in northern Mexico from drug-related violence. In 2005, 1,500 people died from warfare among rival drug warlords. Mexican President Vicente Fox has condemned the attacks on the media, but few arrests have been made against attacks made on journalists. Prosecutors blame the drug violence on a war to control the smuggling routes to the U.S. for cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. Hours before the U.S. Senate tabled a bill proposing the establishment of a $140 billion trust fund for asbestos victims, former North Carolina Senator Locke Faircloth, a lobbyist for Honeywell and Dow Chemical, working to limit the liability of asbestos companies, went to the weekly lunch by the Senate's Republican Policy Committee. The episode came as lawmakers in the House and Senate are seeking to reform the rules on access of lobbyists on Capitol Hill in the wake of the Jack Abramoff scandal. In early February, the House voted to cut off floor access and privileges to the House gym for former lawmakers who are now lobbyists. Roberta Baskin, the director of the Center for Public Integrity, observed that Faircloth's easy access to senators shows the current feeding frenzy for reform is mostly a war of words. The minority Democrats do not allow former senators turned lobbyists to attend their weekly policy lunches. The asbestos bill was killed when the trust fund sponsors could not produce 60 votes to defeat a point of order by Nevada Senator John Ensign, a Republican who opposed the bill for fear it would force taxpayers to pay billions of dollars in asbestos claims. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
Haiti's disorganized but mostly peaceful presidential election on February 7th was followed by charges of fraud and a week of militant protest and street blockades by the country's poor majority. The ballot, Haiti's first national election since the February 2004 overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, concluded with the naming of René Préval as the nation's new head of state. Supporters of Préval, including two members of Haiti's Provisional Electoral Council, alleged that the vote count had been manipulated to deprive Préval of a first-round victory, requiring 50% plus one of the votes cast. After thousands of ballots were found in a Port-au-Prince garbage dump, many marked for Préval, United Nations officials negotiated a resolution to the crisis by redistributing suspect blank ballots among the 34 candidates, naming the former president and Aristide ally as Haiti's new leader. The Bush administration, widely blamed for orchestrating the ouster of President Aristide in 2004, was reported to be pressuring Préval not to allow Aristide to return to Haiti from exile in South Africa. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Fletcher, president of the group Trans Africa Forum, who examines the many challenges ahead for President Préval and Haiti, the hemisphere's poorest nation.
I think it's important for the listener to recognize that the election took place under some of the worst conditions that one could imagine. That first of all, there had been the coup 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, and that was followed by very intense, very bloody, brutal repression of supporters of President Aristide. That was coupled with the role of UN troops, which, much to many people's surprise, was fairly despicable. I mean, they ended up acting effectively as an occupation army for the United States. And then there were technology problems with the voting. So under those conditions, I and many other people, we believed the polls that René Préval had the support, that it would probably be a miracle that somehow the election would be stolen. So I think what we saw was a combination of factors. Préval's popular support was so overwhelming, and in fact, the people were not prepared to sit back and allow the election to be stolen. And I think that that made a big difference. That certainly was coupled by the discovery of ballots that had been thrown away. And I think that that just sealed it in terms of basically forcing the Electoral Council to concede that Préval had the election.
Now, who do you think were the conspirators here, if indeed the accusations, even from some of the electoral board members, that there was overt efforts to manipulate this vote count, if that indeed is true, who were the forces that were trying to deny Préval this first election vote?
The best guess I would have would be the interim, so-called interim government, what I call the puppet government that was put in under La Tortue. I think that they made it very clear in their entire stand that they did not want Préval to win and that they would probably go to whatever steps that they could to keep him out. The apparition in the background in this entire thing is actually three apparitions, the United States, Canada, and France. Those countries did not want a government that was truly representative of the Haitian poor, as they wished in 1990 and again in 2000. They kept wanting a government that was going to advocate the sorts of economic policies that were coming out of Washington. So I think that there was more than likely a nod of some sort by the State Department. But I think that the main culprits were in the interim government.
This election, where it seems, regardless of the flawed vote count, the vast majority of people in Haiti voted for René Préval, who was an ally and successor to President Aristide. Is this vote a vindication of Aristide and his popularity in Haiti?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just a vindication of Aristide's popularity, it's a vindication of the courage of the Haitian people. I mean, we have to keep in mind that in February 2004, the military process of overthrowing President Aristide commenced with an invasion from secret bases in the Dominican Republic of former members of the Haitian military. And President Aristide had gotten rid of the Haitian military because it was such a corrupt, repressive institution. And so some of the former military, including members of death squads, and specifically this terrorist organization, the acronym of which was FRAP, they were involved in overthrowing Aristide. Aristide had no army to stop these thugs from invading the country and ultimately ousting him. And when they succeeded, with the help of the United States, who either kidnapped or whisked away, depending on your point of view, President Aristide, these thugs began a reign of terror. So I think it was certainly a vindication of President Aristide. It was a vindication of the courage of the Haitian people, and it was a defeat for the policies of the Bush administration.
Bill Fletcher, how much pressure do you think René Préval will be under to not allow President Jean-Bertrand Aristide back in the country?
I think that he's going to be under tremendous pressure on several fronts. One is to keep Aristide out. The second will be to make nice with the opposition, those that overthrew President Aristide. And the third is to kowtow to U.S. economic policies. I think that the Bush administration will more than likely approach Préval and say that if he wants to stay in power, he has to go along with the program. And that if he goes along with the program, they'll keep the dogs of war away from him. So I think that the pressure will be intense. After President Aristide was overthrown and he was taken to the Central African Republic and then was liberated from the Central African Republic and went temporarily to Jamaica, that the Bush administration was furious. I mean, their attitude and their words toward the Jamaican prime minister were just simply outrageous. And I'm talking about not just from President Bush, I'm talking specifically about what came from our now Secretary of State. And so that kind of pressure, they do not want President Aristide in this hemisphere. So I think that it's going to be very, very difficult, and we should not be surprised if President Aristide does not return to Haiti for some months.
That was Bill Fletcher, president of the group Trans-Africa Forum. Contact the forum by calling area code 202-223-1960 or visit their website at www.transafricaforum.org. Although the torture scandal at Iraq's infamous Abu Ghraib prison erupted in April 2004, thus far only enlisted military personnel have been prosecuted with no charges brought against officers or government officials. A new set of photos illustrating the brutal forms of abuse practiced at Abu Ghraib during 2003 were published by Salon.com on February 16th, reigniting widespread anger at the U.S. A flood of disclosures about similar torture techniques inflicted on U.S. detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba, and secret prisons has aroused public outrage. Although U.S. Senator John McCain of Arizona successfully sponsored congressional legislation prohibiting cruel and degrading treatment of detainees, critics say that several major loopholes in the bill protects would-be torturers. A United Nations Human Rights Panel issued a report February 15th calling for the immediate closure of the Guantanamo Bay prison facility, labeling it effectively a torture camp where prisoners have no access to justice. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with human rights activist Jennifer Harbury, whose husband, Efrain Bamaca Velasquez, a Guatemalan resistance fighter, was tortured to death and disappeared by military forces on the payroll of the CIA in the early 1990s. Harbury, author of the book Truth, Torture, and the American Way, examines long-standing U.S. policies permitting torture and the damage she maintains is done to the nation as a result.
My husband's name was Efrain Bamaca Velasquez. He was a Mayan villager from Guatemala, like 80% of the population there. The old situation there was very much like the old South Africa in the sense that they were the indigenous population and also the majority, but had virtually no rights and were in a state of starvation. severe malnutrition, extremely high infant mortality rate, et cetera, et cetera. He was captured alive in 1992 by the Guatemalan military. Both the military and the State Department of the United States told us again and again that he had not been captured, that he must have just vanished somewhere, maybe he'd gone off to Mexico, et cetera, et cetera, but that there was no information about him. In fact, he had been captured by a number of military agents who were paid CIA informants. He was then subjected to extreme torture for a period of 2.5 years with the full knowledge and continued payments of the CIA and also with the full knowledge of the State Department. A number of people on Capitol Hill were trying to help me. They asked the State Department again and again for information and were also told there was none. In that 2.5 year period, not only my husband, but 350 other secret prisoners of war were captured and tortured to death. But in fact, as I did more and more research, I found that there were many, many, many cases of severe torture across Latin America when North Americans were in the torture cell. Sometimes they were observing, sometimes they were giving advice, sometimes they were even supervising. And what has even, of course, been the most shocking is that as we see the photographs from Abu Ghraib, as we read the FBI files about what the CIA was doing during these recent interrogation sessions, all of the methods that are being used today were also used on all of these people who had North Americans in their cells. And in fact, those techniques were first developed by the CIA in Vietnam.
Jennifer Harberry, there have been many explanations of the various acts of torture that have been practiced at U.S. prisons in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Guantanamo Naval Base, and the rendering of U.S. detainees to third countries or secret prisons, that explains away acts of torture as an anomaly, as some bad apples, as some out-of-control folks who really have nothing to do with official U.S. policy. What's your reply to that?
Of course, the reason that that keeps being said is because if it is policy or ordered or condoned from the top, then the people at the top go to jail under the doctrine of command responsibility, just like they did at Nuremberg, not just Lindy England at the bottom who was following orders. We have a highly unjust situation there. She should be in jail, so should everybody else all the way up to Rumsfeld. So, of course, that is why they keep saying it was just a few bad apples, which is, by the way, exactly what they said in my case after the truth came out at last through Senator Torricelli. But what we have to look at is the fact that if it was just a few kids out of control on a Saturday night making up those methods for the first time, it would have started there and ended there. In fact, exactly the same techniques have happened in every single prison throughout Iraq under U.S. control, throughout Afghanistan under U.S. control, and throughout Guantanamo. And in fact, documentation has come to light showing that, in fact, these were policies. But what we have is the same techniques, the hot and cold temperatures, prolonged sleep deprivation combined with loud noises and flashing strobe lights, the stress positions, the drownings, the dog attacks, the terror, the threats against the family members, the electrical shocks. All of those things not only have happened throughout all of the different bases that we're now holding detainees at, but it happened wherever we went, Central America, Latin America, back to Vietnam. And so, by the way, did the death squads.
There was a call by a United Nations human rights panel last week demanding the closure of the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. The Bush administration predictably dismissed that report. What do you think the U.N. is doing here, and can they be effective in pressuring the U.S. to close Guantanamo?
Well, there's one problem I have with closing Guantanamo. I think we should close all of our prisons and turn over the detainees to international tribunals, just like we did in Bosnia and Rwanda. That's my first position. I think all of these places should be closed. But just closing Guantanamo, that's one of the few detention centers where most of our lawyers can actually get in and have access to the detainees. If we close Guantanamo, I'm afraid our military and the CIA will just ship them to our secret prisons, and they'll be treated even worse. We won't know where they are. But I'm in full favor of closing all of the prison centers and having all of these people treated exactly the way the Rwanda and Bosnia war criminals were treated.
Well, is there any effective pressure here in this country that could demand that the Bush administration close all these prisons down and subject these people to international law rather than the law of one man, George W. Bush?
That certainly has been recommended by a lot of jurists, but I'm fearing that this administration considers itself not only above the law, but it thinks it is the law.
That was Jennifer Harbury, author of the book Truth, Torture, and the American Way. She currently works with the organization Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition International, or TASSC. Contact the group by calling area code 202-529-2991 or visit their website at www.tassc.org. On February 17th, Yale University President Rick Levin announced that Yale will no longer invest in companies doing business in Sudan and will divest its holdings in at least one oil company that operates there. The university's decision was based on a report by the Allard K. Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic at Yale Law School. The report cited Sudanese government support for the Arab Janjaweed militias implicated in the genocide in Darfur, the western region of Sudan. Sudan is a mid-level oil producer, with foreign oil companies extracting substantial amounts of oil there since 1999. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nick Robinson, a third-year law student at Yale and director of the school's Human Rights Clinic. Robinson, one of the main authors of the Darfur report, explains the involvement of foreign oil companies in Sudan and how the divestment movement on campuses is spreading, similar to the movement to divest from apartheid South Africa in the 1980s.
I think the oil companies are the ones that you can most clearly make the connection between supporting the government and the genocide in Sudan. Currently, a little bit over half of the revenue that the government of Sudan receives is from oil revenue, and the other half comes from taxes and other sources of revenue. You can track military spending and increases in military spending by the government of Sudan to the increased revenue that's coming in. So the government of Sudan is buying helicopters and airplanes that have been used to bomb villages in Darfur. They have used that money to pay off the Janjaweed to carry out many of these atrocities. And they've used the money to buy weapons that have then gone into further fuel the conflict.
Does the U.S. sell weapons, any kind of military equipment to Sudan?
Not that I'm aware of. Currently, there's Sudan is on the State Department's list of countries that are state sponsors of terrorism. Therefore, there's U.S. sanctions against Sudan. So one important point to keep in mind is that no U.S. companies theoretically are supposed to be doing business in Sudan.
Do you know any that are?
I'm not aware of any large business activities. For some reason, Coca-Cola still sells Coca-Cola in Sudan, but as far as I'm aware, Coca-Cola sells Coke everywhere. I don't know how they get around sanctions in different countries.
The Yale Corporation, which is the governing body of the university, decided to take action after reading your report. So what was in the report?
The report detailed out some 30-odd companies that were doing business in Sudan, particularly in the oil, electricity, and telecom sector, and did an analysis of looking into what the companies were doing in Sudan, what their activities were, and what sort of assistance this gave to the government in Sudan to carry out atrocities in Darfur.
Now, Yale was invested in those oil companies in particular. I've never heard of any of those oil companies. They're certainly not the big ones we know of. They're certainly, at least a couple of them were Chinese, weren't they?
That's correct. The three big oil companies that they divested from are PetroChina, which is one of the largest oil companies in China, ONGC, which is the state-run Indian Oil Company, which also has a 10% equity share that you can buy into, and Sinopec, which I think is the third largest Chinese oil company.
How much was the investment? Do you know how much Yale had invested in these companies?
Yale's investments are notoriously secret. Yale has a very high return on its endowment, and so they have a lot of reasons to keep where their investments are secret. However, I believe President Levin said that they were invested in at least one of the companies. He wouldn't say which one or for how much. But the point about divestment is not only about which companies we're invested in now, but also that the university makes a commitment not to invest in these companies in the future.
Do you know how big this divestment movement is? Do other campuses, are other campuses involved also?
The divestment movement began at Harvard last fall when Harvard announced that it was going to divest from PetroChina. Last spring, both Stanford and then later Dartmouth announced that they were divesting from, I believe, Stanford from three companies and Dartmouth from four. Amherst recently announced it was divesting from a list of companies. We get inquiries from other student groups and even other investment offices from other universities about divestment, including schools such as Brown, Columbia, Northwestern.
I heard that you are also meeting with officials in the Connecticut state government to talk about divestment. Is that right?
That's correct. We've been meeting with several representatives in the state legislature about divestment, as well as the state treasurer's office. It's not just students here at Yale, but a broad coalition, including people from the Anti-Defamation League, people from the Catholic Church, people from synagogues at other universities such as Wesleyan, that are concerned about this issue. The treasurer's office has been very supportive, and I think sometime next week there's going to be a bill introduced to give authority to the treasurer's office to divest from companies that do business in Sudan.
Nick Robinson, how did you get involved in this issue of Darfur?
I mean, it's just such a compelling issue. I remember growing up when Rwanda happened, I was just beginning high school, late middle school, and just kind of at the beginning of kind of my political consciousness. But even then, I remember thinking, what could I do? You know, then even though it happened in a very short period of time. And when the genocide in Sudan started making the headlines in the news, not only I but other students here at this university became very concerned and just wondered what could we do so that we wouldn't repeat the mistakes of Rwanda. And unfortunately, we have repeated many of those mistakes. If Sudan was 100 days like Rwanda was, it would have been over a long time ago. But we're still mobilizing around this issue because the killing's still going on. A lot of people have died, but a lot of people still can die.
That was Nick Robinson of the Allard K. Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic at Yale Law School. For a copy of the report on Darfur, visit the Yale Advisory Committee on Investor Responsibility at www.acir.yale.edu or call the Human Rights Clinic at area code 203-432-1729. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.